It's Noise and Notes, and I'm Philip Bailey. Shawnell Harrison is a Louisville filmmaker. His debut is Concrete Dust, The Raising of Shepherd Square. It's a documentary about the city tearing down the 70-year-old housing complex in the historic Smoketown neighborhood. Harrison stopped by to talk about his production process, the raw feelings among displaced residents, and how the media covers the city's poor.
When you around people that don't get a voice, it's great to hear them purge themselves of all the shit they go through. It's cathartic for myself. And I enjoyed watching that process, and I love the rawness of it because it's, you know, I like the real shit about it.
Yeah, I think that what people hear, they see the news coverage. If they get their news from the television, it's 30 seconds, maybe a minute and 30 seconds. If it's in the newspaper, it's a couple of quotes and it's sort of distant. Maybe some pictures are in there. And even if it's on the radio, they hear it, but they don't see it. You give a lot of time. Let's talk a little bit about the way in which you went about making the film. I noticed that you mixed a lot of quotes from Muhammad Ali in there.
Yeah.
People who don't know this, Ali started his boxing career in the Presbyterian Community Center at Shepherd Square in the Smoketown neighborhood. Is that why you included him?
Yeah, that's exactly why I included him. And I felt like I needed some type of almost disembodied voice to kind of add a little punctuation to the visuals. And what great what better voice could you have but him? But before we go on, I need to shout out my wife.
Don't hit the table.
Oh, I'm sorry. There you go. Sorry about that. I need to shout out my wife real quick. My wife supported me through this process. I was broke during the whole process, unemployed, and she let my black ass out of the house to go do this. You know what I'm saying? So that's great. I love you, Fran Thompson. I love you, baby. Go ahead.
You're being honest again.
Yeah, right. You know what I'm saying?
Because, you know, you had Ali there. Another thing I noticed, you used a lot of classic music. And you mentioned Spike Lee. It reminded me of When the Levees Broke.
Right, exactly.
You have these big operatic, symphonic,
long
musical scenes in the film.
Right. You know, I did that because it's the obvious choice would have been to you know, blanket the whole thing with hip-hop. I love hip-hop, but I wanted to go against the grain on that. I think if you add orchestral music to anything, it adds a little emphasis to what you're seeing. And that was the purpose behind all that. I've always been a weird kid. Let me explain that shit and why I chose orchestral music. Because, you know, I'm very eclectic with my music taste. I was the only black kid that had the Beach Boys. The Beach Boys, Eric B. and Rakim, the fucking Beetlejuice soundtrack.
So,
you know,
wait.
In my tape.
Wait.
You know what I'm saying?
Your musical soundtrack was Eric B., Rakim, Beetlejuice.
Yeah, the soundtrack.
And the Beach Boys.
I got my Danny Elfman on.
I remember doing my first story on Shepherd Square about 3 years ago. And I remember I talked to Kashana Hughes. She was a mother of four. I'm not sure if she still lives in Shepherd. She might have probably moved out now they're demolishing it. She talked about being threatened by a drug dealer who was selling drugs on her porch. And I noticed throughout the film, people complain about the negative images that they see on the news about Shepherd Square. But, I mean, that's what people talked about in the film. People said, you know, I hear gunshots every day.
That stuff exists. I'm not trying to cover that up. I'm a proponent of people moving out. The stuff exists. People talked about that because that's what actually goes on.
People are directly clashing with the violence that they might say, well, I don't like to see it on the news. But if you talk to them honestly, they'll say, well, listen.
This is what happens.
Yeah.
Right. Because it does. I mean, there's no way around it. You know what I'm saying? But I love it. And underneath all the stuff about the violence, there's a sense of camaraderie against within the community that we don't see.
Versus them.
Right. Exactly. Exactly.
And I think John Bull did a story years ago on this, how the statistics show that the crimes that are committed in the housing complex, whether Beecher Terrace, Parkway Place, better known as Park Hill, Shepherd Square, and the former housing projects like Clarksdale and Southwick, that the majority of people who commit the crimes do not live or do not actually live in the housing projects.
I don't know if that's actually true. I think it's a little bit of both. I think people come from somewhere else and do it, and there's people in the community that do that thing too. I think it's a little bit of both. People in the community, people outside of the community. But that's not all that's there. You know what I'm saying? There's people that love each other and to look out for each other and may, you know, provide you with sugar if you need it. You know what I'm saying? So,
because that's what Ijeudé Travis talked about, that her concern primarily is that you're breaking this community up, you're scattering people across the city. Over time, over years, whatever you think about this community, whether it might be the headquarters for all these social miseries that we talk about in the public sphere, but at the end of the day, there is a sense of camaraderie here.
Exactly.
The person knows me down the street. The person in my building knows who I am. if they haven't seen me in a few days, they come in and check on me.
Right.
I'm losing that just being thrown into this other community.
Right. Exactly. They're, because everybody's so compact in that neighborhood, it would be hard for you not to establish relationships. You know what I'm saying? One thing you got to understand, these people that live in these communities are human beings. They have dreams and aspirations like everybody else.
Do you think the people in the larger city see that, that they're human beings?
In this city? No, I do not. I don't think so. I think they succumb to what they see on the news, which nine times out of ten, it's a negative view, and that view is valid. I'm not trying to say it's not, but that's the only view that they get. They don't know that there's people like Miss Travis who has started her own business in her home. They don't know that the Coach D and Coach Dre are actually in the music industry or are nurturing kids to deter them from violence. They don't know that.
And why is it they don't know that? I mean, is that the news media's fault, or is that the fault of that community being so isolated?
It's everybody's fault. You know what I'm saying? Because I think the news operates under the guise of wanting to be balanced, but how can you be balanced when all you show is a negative aspect?
And I want to ask you this question, because this comes up in the debates about this all the time. If you're living in government housing, do you have any real ownership of that place?
On paper, no. But with like more, and you have an intrinsic, value of that place that maybe we don't see on the surface. But again, there's community, there's people you know, there's all these different things that you're used to, that you're accustomed to. So yes, you do own in that sense.
One thing you did in your piece I thought was interesting. I got to ask you why you did it. The head of the housing authority.
Yeah. What's my man's name? Barry somebody.
Tim Barry.
Tim Barry. I got his name off.
Tim Barry, the head of the housing authority, who gets a lot of darts thrown at him by residents. There's a part of the documentary where you talk to him.
Yeah.
And you can't hear him over the music. But hold on. And you can't hear him over the music, but you show the graffiti or people write pretty expletive words about the housing authority. What was the message in that? Because I think you did it for a reason.
I have to struggle to hear him. Let me preface by saying that wasn't my intent to at first. When I interviewed a guy, it was just, you know, I went to interview him, see what he had to say. But as I was on the ground talking to people and got their feeling about the whole process, and him, he's included in that, there's nothing positive they have to say about this guy. So that's not me saying.
Yeah, because I think what you were, correct me if I'm wrong, what I got from it was,
that's how the residents felt.
You were
about
literally
him.
Saying, this is what the residents hear right. When they see him and hear him talk.
Exactly.
It's almost like the old Charlie Brown cartoons when the adults would talk and it would just sound.
Wah, wah, wah. Right.
That's what people hear when they hear Tim Barry speak.
Exactly. That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
Because even the residents there admit in your documentary, I do not like this place.
No.
So isn't tearing them down what people want?
Yeah, I think so. You run into a lot of dual talk, people, which comes off as contradictory. Some people say, you know, I don't want to live here, but then I love living here. I guess it's a struggle because it's familiarity, and what's new is kind of scary.
You tease us a little bit at the end. You say to be continued, and you say we're going across that infamous 9th Street divide. What's your next project?
I'm gearing up to do one on the West End, which is where I'm from. I'm gearing up to do one on the West End. I'm going to be following people and to see what we come up with.
And is this going to be a series or?
You know what? In my mind, it's a three-part series. I have no, I don't know why, how that came to be. It's just in my mind, that's what it's going to be. It's all based upon Black disparity.
Well, I loved the documentary.
Thank you. I appreciate it, brother.
Concrete Dust, a documentary on the raising of Shepherd Square. Shaunwell Harrison, thank you for joining us.
No, thank you, bro. I appreciate it. Good luck on your show, man.
The country is talking about guns again after the massacre in Aurora, Colorado. Everyone says it was a tragedy, but agree on little else. I talked with Democratic activist Sean Riley and gun range manager Eric Norris about the impasse in the Second Amendment debate.
In 2003, in college at U of L, my best friend and roommate was shot and killed outside of our Highlands apartment. And after that, I really started to pay attention to gun control, gun policies. You know, at that time, I had owned a shotgun. I had owned a rifle before that. I had been to shooting ranges. I had shot handguns, target practice, with my friend and his father. We had been to gun ranges. And so I'd, you know, seeing how guns can be handled safely and seeing you know, the proper way to shoot and the proper way to handle guns and the proper way to really respect the firearm that's in your hand, and then jumping to my friend's murder, just somebody blatantly opening fire with no regard for who's in front of them or what's going on, just shooting to kill, essentially.
Now, Eric, let me ask you. Certainly, the Second Amendment is a bedrock of our Constitution. It's the Second Amendment.
Correct.
But you hear stories like that, not only what happened in Colorado, but smaller cases of gun violence. What are your thought processes when you hear something like that?
Well, it's first and foremost, it's horror. I mean, as somebody that is a law-abiding citizen that owns guns, it's just absolute horror. And it's, the families of those victims and the victims themselves, it's just, I can't imagine the rebuilding process that they'll have to go through. Same with Sean's friend. It's terrible. It's unfortunate, though, with gun control, it would not have stopped either of those incidents in all likelihood. The criminals continue to get firearms regardless of whether a law-abiding citizen has one or not.
I've heard gun control advocates compare firearms to automobiles. I think that's maybe one of the better comparisons that I've heard. The comparisons that you have insurance, age limits, mandatory tests for driving a car. Eric, why not have the same rules and regulations for guns?
Well, that's a good parallel, and I look at that from the standpoint that having a licensing process and having to have insurance on an automobile does not prevent drivers from driving uninsured. It doesn't prevent them from driving without a driver's license.
But we do have certain tests that a person who maybe doesn't have the right vision, or if they perhaps shouldn't be on the road. I mean, we have a test to make sure they should be on there in the first place. We don't have that for guns, and I understand that firearms are different from automobiles in some people's minds. It's a constitutional right. But something that can be so devastating, shouldn't we have some regulation, not to take away those guns from law-abiding citizens such as yourself, but that we should have some sort of tests to find out who actually has these weapons, these deadly weapons?
Well, the same thing applies with the automobiles. Basically, the driver that wants to drive is going to drive without a license or insurance if they see fit to do so. It happens all the time. Kentucky has very strict laws with regard to license, driving without insurance, and people do it all the time. So it's not the law-abiding citizens that you have to worry about with this testing process. It's the criminals, and the criminals aren't going to come in for testing on a gun.
You know that line of argument of, you know, we don't need regulations because criminals are always going to get around the regulations. And that type of argument, it's really a straw man in terms of, you know, we've seen that regulations will reduce the number of automobile deaths. So putting some moderate restrictions on guns can and will reduce the amount of gun violence in this country. And Eric made a point that the shootings may not have been prevented by gun regulations, but the fact of the matter is the assault rifle that James Holmes had been banned under the assault weapons ban that lapsed. His 100-round magazine had previously been banned, and so those weapons were available to him because of that lapse in the assault weapons ban.
Well, the statistics show that criminals generally don't use assault rifles. Yes, it happened in this situation, but the statistics are they just don't. They're bulky. They're heavy. They're not concealable. It's not something that is generally.
So you would
used
support reinstituting the assault?
No,
ban.
Actually, I don't support that at all. The Constitution does not, it gives you a right to bear arms. It doesn't give you a right to bear arms based on need. It's just purely a right to bear arms. And obviously the basis of that was to protect against a tyrannical government. And our military is obviously very well armed. So,
because you meet people who are on a spectrum. There are many people some people are liberal enough to believe, I don't want any guns in my home whatsoever, at all. Safety pins, safety locks, nothing. There are those who believe, no, I should have a right to have guns in my person, in my home, in my car, even on me, depending on what that type of weapon is. And then there are those who believe that, as you said, Mr. Norris, earlier, even assault rifles, they're not, shouldn't be banned necessarily. Is there a consensus on this at all? Because it seems that Democrat, Republican politicians do not want to touch this issue.
Getting into the political side of this, you know, we can argue the statistics all day. You can make them do whatever you want when you're looking at it. But, you know, I think for a long time, the NRA has been really holding the public and holding our legislators hostage at the end of a gun, you know, to not do anything. And with this perception that they
That's a pretty harsh language, though. I mean, is it at the end of the day, isn't it Democrats don't want to do anything? I mean,
well, I mean, you know,
NRA is not giving money to those Democrats.
No, they're not. And they're, you know, with the threat of money and politics now, and with Citizens Unite, you can spend unlimited sums of cash. You know, if you go against the NRA is threatening to, you know, you spend $1 million in your district. The NRA is a very small, very narrow interest group with only 2.5 million members. They are, in terms of political groups, they are very weak except outside of the money that they have. And, you know, that's, you know, we can get into money and politics on another debate, but I think that people have been scared of the NRA, spending money in their district, them using the tactics of fear, using arguments saying everyone's take your guns away, when in fact, you know, most people want sensible regulation on guns.
You still own a gun?
No, I do not.
So you don't believe that people should own guns at all?
No, I believe people should own guns. I brought a picture of me last summer shooting a rifle, high-powered rifle, and then a picture of me shooting some clay pigeons with some shotguns. And this was last summer. So I fully believe and support in people's right to own guns. Where it comes down to is,
you believe people should be able to carry guns publicly?
Well, and then you get into a constitutional question on carrying guns in public. Concealed carry, I would adamantly be against concealed carry in any and all circumstances.
So you believe in open carry?
Yeah, open carry. Walking around, if people want to see the guns that you have.
Even in the state capitol?
No, not in the state capitol. You know, obviously there's lots of restrictions on the Second Amendment already. There's restrictions on where you can carry guns. Most government federal buildings, no guns
allowed.
Now, Eric,
what's wrong with that? I mean, we have restrictions on. Sean wrote an essay comparing what happened in the theater in Aurora. You can't yell fire in a theater. Why should you be able to carry a gun in a theater? We have restrictions on the First Amendment, which I think you would agree is a bedrock of our Constitution as well. What's wrong with restrictions on the Second Amendment?
Well, we do have restrictions on the Second Amendment, as Sean just mentioned. There are a lot of restrictions on the Second Amendment at this point. Fully automatic weapons are obviously very, very difficult to get for an individual. It's 6 months of wait plus a $300 tax stamp. So you've got a ton of restrictions that are already in place. And by the way, Sean, that rifle that you're shooting is far more powerful than an assault rifle. And that's another thing.
Huh? You would know.
Absolutely.
But it can only shoot one bullet at a time.
Well, there are lots of hunting rifles that'll shoot five, because that's what the regulation is. You can have five.
Let me ask you, I'm sure you own a gun.
I do.
Do you believe that we should be able to carry open carry?
Yes, and I think that's been the law for a long time. And yes, I do believe that we should be able to carry concealed. I think
even in the state capitol.
You know, in the state capitol, there are restrictions at this point in government buildings. So
not in the state capitol here in Kentucky.
Right. Right,
so,
but in other government buildings, it is prohibited.
Well, we're here in Kentucky. I'm not in Michigan or Florida or any other state. In Kentucky, should we be able to openly carry firearms in the state capitol?
You know, I think I would leave that to the legislature. Let them
decide. Oh,
don't
pass the buck.
No, I don't really have...
You're a proud Second Amendment advocate. I'm not going to let you get away with that. What do you think that people should be able to carry those weapons?
Honestly, I do believe that. I really do. I don't see it being any different than any other place, because as long as they're law-abiding citizens, I don't see the problem with that. Those are not the people that you have to worry about. It's the people that are out to commit crimes that you have to be concerned with.
Some of the hard numbers are murder rates. That's a hard number to fudge. People being killed with guns, and a correlation between murder rates and gun regulations. Those are hard numbers too. So if putting a ban on assault weapons saves 12 lives, I think that would be worth it.
Well, based on that argument, wouldn't you want to ban all guns if you're making the argument that
well, again, I'm a believer in the Second Amendment, and I believe people have the right to bear arms, but I believe that there are limitations on our rights. There's limitations on every right that we have. And so imposing sensible limitations on certain types of weapons that can commit mass murder in a matter of seconds, I think is reasonable.
You can make a homemade bomb to do the same thing. It's just the weapon, the choice of the tool is up to the individual criminal that's doing that. I mean, he could use just as easily make a homemade bomb from fertilizer and destroy as many lives.
So, Eric, in your mind, if someone was there who was a law-abiding citizen who was armed, they could have stopped any one of these massacres if a real responsible citizen had also been armed.
To talk to Sean's point when he was talking about the body armor, and I will dispute that. If you get hit in the chest with wearing body armor, you're going to go down, even though it's not going to penetrate necessarily. It's like getting hit by a linebacker. You're going to go down. And
through the smoke, through a dark smoke crowded theater,
Yeah, somebody that was within range, absolutely. We train on that all the time. We do Israeli combat training, and we do training. We've got some Navy SEALs coming in to do training.
So you believe people should be trained, at least?
Absolutely. No question.
So you do believe in some form of regulation that, that people, if they buy a gun, they should be trained to have that gun?
I don't believe they should be forced to be trained, but I think it makes good common sense. And
well, why
that's
not?
That's one of the things that we...
You're someone who owns a gun range, so you know, I mean, you probably can identify what type, model, range, all that from a gun. So you know the power of these weapons.
Absolutely.
Should there be an age limit?
We have age limits on kids coming in and shooting at our
range. I know you
range.
Do, but should there be an age limit?
I think that it's a common sense thing for the average
parent to make
that decision.
We don't let
10-year-olds
drive. We don't let
10-year-olds
can't
drive.
See
over the window.
We don't let 15-year-olds drive.
Right.
So what's the so is there so I th- so, I've had
a, so it's arbitrary then.
No, I just think that it is. I think that you're honest and sincere in your belief in the Second Amendment, and I think that's a part of this country that will never go away, and that's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
But I think even you acknowledged, at least with the idea of training someone, because you acknowledged that if someone was there with Mr. Holmes or any of these massacres, they would have to be trained to know where to shoot.
Oh, of course.
So you believe in people should be trained. So you
absolutely.
Believe in some form of regulation.
Yes, and absolutely I do.
So
and
why
I,
not age limits? Why not?
So what is that arbitrary age limit? Because I live in Oldham County.
That's what the First Amendment is for.
Yeah, right. That's right. That's why we're here. I live in Oldham County where we actually do have 4-H shooting still in the school system. And those kids are shooting as early as 8 years old, and we allow.
So you
kids,
believe an 8-year-old should have a gun?
No, I believe an 8-year-old should be with a parent.
What's
learning
the age
how to
limit? I'm gonna. What is
I'll
age
say
limit?
8. I'll say 8 with
so you
a
believe
parent.
A 10-year-old should be able to have a gun?
No, absolutely not.
So, but she'll learn how to shoot one. So what's the age limit for someone to buy and own a gun?
Well, it's 21 for a handgun and 18 for a long gun right now.
So you're okay with that?
Yes, absolutely.
I'll ask you both of you as a final question on this. Given this tragedy, I mean it. There's all in all likelihood this will happen again, someplace somewhere. Is there ever going to be a consensus, or have we already reached that consensus?
I think that a consensus will develop. I think it's got to. It's going to reach a breaking point if we keep, you know, moving down the road to lax gun laws. Everybody owns a gun. The murder rates will continually increase. So at some point, we'll reach a tipping point where we've had enough had enough of these massacres, we've had enough of these killings, and people will just be sick of it and then vote into office people that will stand up for people's right to life and the pursuit of happiness.
Well, we actually do have a consensus at this point. The majority of Americans do believe in the Second Amendment and do believe that we should be able to possess and own firearms. And it's I don't see that changing, hopefully. The gun law in 1994, the assault rifle ban did not do anything to dent the murder rate. So I've got the statistics to show that. So I don't believe that that's going to make a difference at all. And, you know, hopefully the government doesn't continue to infringe upon our rights.
Eric Norris, Sean Wiley, thanks for joining me.
Thanks, Philip.
Thanks.
Noise and Notes on WFPL is produced by me, Philip Bailey, with Joe Durso. For more, visit WFPL.org.